So we're reading the Larger Puran Sutra. This is the story of how Amida became a Buddha. And it's set in a sort of mythic time. There's no evidence that this happened, but Shakyamuni Buddha, who we do have evidence for his life, told this story. And he lived 2,500 years ago, and he said that this happened sort of thousands of years before he was alive. So I understand it to be him expressing something of the spiritual life through this story. And what he's trying to describe, part of what he's trying to describe, is the character of what he has faith in. And in this instance, he talks about Amida, but you could say he has faith in all other Buddhas, in all other enlightened beings. And this is a description of the enlightened being that is Amida. And it's also a description of the Pure Land of Amida. Pure Land is an English translation of a Chinese translation of a Sanskrit word, which a better English translation might be Buddha field, or a more literal translation. So we think of the field of influence that a Buddha has. So we talked about if somebody's very charismatic and you come into the room, you get caught up in their influence. And if they're sort of charismatic and teaching compassion, then naturally people around them find themselves enthused for goodness's sake. And this is what a Buddha does. So a Pure Land is any area really where there's a Buddha who is influencing other people. And in the middle of this sutra, there are 48 vows, and the vows are made by a monk called Dharmakara, which is Amida's name before he becomes Amida. And in these vows, you could say he describes his Pure Land, but he also describes, or they're all framed in such a way as to describe the characteristics of people who come under his influence. So when a person comes into my Pure Land, when they come into my influence, these things will be true about them. Naturally, they will tend towards these characteristics. So it's a list of ideals that a Buddha inspires. So we can take it, or we can use it in two ways. We can use it as a list of ideals for our own practice, as we did a little bit the last time we were looking at this. Or we can use it to try and get a sense of who the Buddha is, in that he inspires these ideals. And any list of ideals in Buddhism, whatever it is, you can use them. Again, you can use a list of ideals in two ways. Either you can use them as something to reach towards, or you can use them as something to measure your own practice against. Maybe that's two ways of saying the same thing. If you find yourself falling short of any of these ideals, from a Pure Land point of view, we would say that that comes from a lack of faith. You're either, in every moment, you're either taking refuge in yourself, which is often in defensiveness or self-protection, or you're taking refuge in something greater than yourself, in the Buddha. You're trusting that the Buddha is there, that behaving in a compassionate way will produce the right results, that even if you behave in a compassionate way and that creates conflict, actually the Buddha is still there holding you. So anytime you shy away, your practice falls short of these ideals, you can understand it as a lack of faith, or as taking refuge in yourself instead of in the Buddha. But of course this happens all the time, and that's okay, because the Buddha is there regardless of whether you have faith or not. So last month, we did vows 1 to 9, and I want to go on and do the next 9 this evening. And I'll say a little bit about each one. If you want to ask a question as we go along, do, but obviously just with an awareness that that will be on the tape. But I'm particularly interested to get to the 18th vow. because that's the one that excites me. So if I do, forgive me if I skip over the others. So the 10th verse, so this is the Amida is Amida. The monk that becomes the Amida is sitting in front of his own spiritual teacher and making these vows. And he says, O blessed one. So he's talking to his own spiritual teacher. May I not come to complete awakening? If when I have done so, beings in my Pure Land should have the least sense of property, even in regard to their own bodies or their very selves, or if they should give rise to thoughts and feelings associated with craving for objects of desire. So again, there's this framing of the vow in such a way that I won't become enlightened unless it's the case that when I am enlightened, the beings around me in my Pure Land aren't interested in getting things for themselves. It's fairly self-explanatory, really. And you can, in a way, it comes out of what I was talking about before. When we are after things for ourselves, we're sort of really, or when we do it in that grasping way, it comes out of a lack of faith in something greater. We're usually getting stuff in order to prop up a particular defense of self. And that's, you know, that's pretty standard Buddhist stuff. And that really fits in with the other vows that we looked at last week about behaviour and so on. So the 11th vow is called irreversibility, and it says, O blessed one, may I not come to the complete awakening if when I have done so, beings in my Pure Land should not all be those for whom all is completely assured. They will definitely attain Nirvana. So, everybody who comes into the influence of this Buddha is going to become enlightened, guaranteed. What I will say is that Amida is the Buddha that is present for us in this lifetime. It's the Buddha that we can have a spiritual connection with. So, as we practice the Nembutsu, making a connection with that Buddha, we are entering this Buddha's influence. So as we do that, the more that we do that, the more true all of these things will become for us. So the more able we are to enter the Buddha's influence in this lifetime, the more guaranteed our enlightenment will be. The 12th vow is, may I not come to complete awakening if when I have done so, the radiance of light I display should have a limit and not be able to penetrate the myriad Pure Lands. What this is saying is Amida is present everywhere, regardless of where you are, not only in his own area of influence, but also in the area, also in the Pure Lands of other spiritual teachers, which it speaks to the universal spirit of this teaching. There is something that you can lean into regardless of where you are. And regardless of what your spiritual practice is, you can still connect with this Buddha if you want to. The 13th vow says this, but in terms of time. So that's in terms of space. Wherever you are in the world, you can connect with the Buddha if you want to. The 13th vow is, O blessed one, may I not come to the complete awakening if when I've done so, my lifespan should have a limit. So this is about time. Whenever you're alive, Amida Buddha is present. There is something that you can lean into, whether you're living in the past, the present, or the future. Because this Buddha has an infinite lifespan, you can always connect with it. The 14th vow is, may I not come to the complete awakening if when I have done so, the number of Shravakas in my Pure Land were not so numerous as to be on... O blessed one, may I not come to the complete awakening if when I have done so, the number of Shravakas in my Pure Land were not so numerous as to be beyond the fathoming of ordinary beings, even were they all to become Pratyeka Buddhas. There are some sort of... You know, the sutra isn't written in a way which is necessarily easy to understand. I think it could be written in an easy way. So, it's a couple of Sanskrit words. So, a Shravaka just means a disciple of somebody. A Pratyeka Buddha is somebody who becomes enlightened without a teacher. So, this vow is saying, may I not come to the complete awakening if when I've done so, the number of disciples in my pure land aren't, you know, there's more disciples in my pure land than can be counted by ordinary people, even if those ordinary people all became enlightened without a teacher, something like that.
Read it again.
O Blessed One, may I not come to the complete awakening if when I have done so, the number of Shravakas, disciples, in my pure land were not so numerous as to be beyond the fathoming of ordinary beings, even were they all to become Pratyeka Buddhas.
Beyond the fathoming. Beyond the fathoming.
The lesson, what Dharmavidya takes from this vow is that whether we can work out the grammar of it or not, is that it's suggesting that discipleship is a better way to go than becoming enlightened under your own steam. So, a Shravaka is, this is Dharmavidya, a Shravakas are disciples. They are those who listen and hear. They hang on the teachings of the Buddha. Bodhisattvas are all Shravakas, so people who live for the benefit of others are all Shravakas. Some Buddhist texts implicitly disparage Shravakas as inferior to Bodhisattvas. It is true that a Bodhisattva is a Shravaka plus, but here there is a quite clear and slightly ironic implication that Shravakas have something that Pratyeka Buddhas would not understand, and certainly a boast that no Pratyeka Buddha could fathom the extent of the workings of a Amida. Okay.
Isn't that a bit elitist?
Well, yes. And my suspicion, you know, although these are all describing an ideal, is that they are, that the ideal is being described by spiritual teachers, but they're also ordinary people as well, so they'll put their own biases into the text, and it's come to us over several different translations and so on. And it is a text about being in relationship to something rather than trying to do it on your own, I suppose. But, you know, my experience of people who practice without teachers is that you still get to a place that's beyond yourself, and whether you describe, you know, you can describe that in negative terms like selflessness, emptiness, and so on, or you can describe that in positive terms. So the Pure Land is an expression of the place beyond self in positive terms, Pure Land, Amida Buddha, and so on. But I think there's an equivalence between that and between people who talk about deconstructing the self and coming to emptiness as well. Practically, I think a lot of people, spiritual practice benefits from being in relationships, but I'm not going, you know, I don't rule out the possibility that people can become enlightened on their own. I suppose what it's saying is that if you do become enlightened on your own, you may not understand why being in relationship is so important. Well, you know, I can understand that, because if you haven't experienced it, maybe you can't. But I think you're right. I think possibly it's a little bit political maybe as well. The 15th vow is that beings who go into the Pure Land should have an infinite lifespan, except insofar as they choose to manifest in a mortal state in fulfillment of their holy vows. So this teaching is given in the context of people having many lifetimes. And in a culture which understands that some beings, like like gods and so on, have lifetimes that are very, very long. And what this verse says, if you go into my pure land, you can stay here for as long as you like. You can live forever in a state of bliss, or you can return to the world in a mortal state where you will die again in fulfillment of your holy vows, which are the bodhisattva vows, to save all sentient beings. So you can understand it in that context, or you can simply understand it as a description of when you are in communion with the Buddha, you may have a different experience of time and a sense of the eternal. So even if your connection with the Buddha, you know, even if you feel an intense connection with the Buddha as measured on the clock by just for a couple of minutes, when you're experiencing that, it can feel like you're in touch with something eternal, and even that the time is eternal. Then you come away from that into the world in order to complete your bodhisattva vows. And what this is saying is actually you can do either of those. You can just practice in order to be in connection with the Buddha, or you can practice, be in connection with the Buddha, and then take that spirit, take what you've learnt into the world in order to help all beings. And both, this vow at least, doesn't value one path above the other. The 16th vow says, O Blessed One, may I not come to the complete awakening if when I have done so, beings in my land should ever so much as hear the suggestion that someone is non-virtuous. So, we won't even talk about people's flaws in the Pure Land. Yeah. Well, and here, it's these are vows, so it's expressed in that way. And when it's expressed as a vow, the danger is that, well, not the danger, you can do the practice. And when those thoughts come up, you are mindful of them and you don't speak them. But the Buddha doesn't experience those thoughts coming up in the first place, because when he looks at a person, if he sees somebody behaving unskillfully, he understands the causes and conditions that lead to that behaviour, and he can also see that however dysfunctionally it comes out, the action is motivated by love on some level. And that's what the Buddha pays attention to. So with all of that in the picture, naturally, he doesn't, or she doesn't, suggest that anybody is non-virtuous. They understand that everybody is virtuous. They just, that's it. They understand that everybody is virtuous. So we can take that as a practice, a very difficult practice. You can try and do that for a week. Or the same as all of these, as I said earlier, you can take them as an ideal for your own practice, or you can also understand them as a way of describing the character of a Buddha that we relate to. O Blessed One, may I not come to the complete awakening. So we're coming to the three great vows. This is 17. This is the one before the three great vows, but it's also important. O Blessed One, may I not come to the complete awakening if when I have done so, one cannot hear all the Buddhas throughout the cosmos praising and glorifying the name. So the name is Amida Buddha, that's our practice. And what he's saying here is, every awakened spiritual teacher must hold this practice, this Buddha, in esteem. And they do that because it is naturally a good thing to esteem, this unlimited love, compassion, and wisdom. So he's not saying, everybody must love me, otherwise I'm not going to do anything. He's saying, actually, I need to be at a place where naturally love is pouring forth and virtue is pouring forth and so on. And when I'm in that place, all these other enlightened spiritual teachers will look at me and naturally they'll praise me because those actions, I'll be unfolding those actions. And it also speaks to the universal nature of the practice. The last time we did this, I mentioned that line from, I think it's one of the precepts, that talks about understanding that other people may hear the name spoken to their heart in their own secret language. So we're not just talking about people who say the words Namo Amida Guru Amitabha, or as we understand them in English or Sanskrit or Japanese. We're also talking about anybody who puts their trust, puts their heart in connection with something that is unlimited love, unlimited compassion, unlimited wisdom. Anyone who's practices that connection with a Buddha, even if they don't use those words, then why would they? Because they come from a particular culture. That practice is to be glorified and praised. Okay, so now we come to the nub of it all, the three great vows. Often just referred to, so these are the 18th and 19th and 20th vows of this sutra, but they're often just called the three great vows because of the importance they have to the Pure Land tradition. So the first one is about hearing the Nembutsu. Anybody who hears the Nembutsu and has faith will be reborn in my Pure Land. The second one is anybody who cultivates all the virtues and has faith in me and wishes to be born in my land will go to the Pure Land. So that's about doing good works and about doing spiritual practices. And the third is about samadhi. Which is about spiritual practice. Now, I'm pausing because there's different ways of talking about. Well, people often talk about the three vows as having a sequence, and depending on whether what sort of Buddhism you practice, you might understand the sequence in different ways. But I think they're more of a cycle, really. So the first vow says, O blessed one, may I not come to the complete awakening if when I have done so, living beings inhabiting other worlds who conceive a longing for awakening, who listen to my name, who set their heart upon being reborn in my Pure Land, and who keep me in mind with settled faith, are not assured of meeting me standing before them in full retinue and glory at the time of their death, such death as being completely free of anxiety. So this is about trust, and it's about, none of the vows in this are about reciting the Nembutsu. The only one that mentions it here is about listening to the Nembutsu. So we hear Amida's call, we have faith in Amida, we wish to be reborn in the Pure Land. If we meet all those conditions, we will be reborn in the Pure Land. Now, you can take this as the beginning of the cycle or as the end of the cycle. If you take it as the beginning of the cycle, you would say that, well, in order to come into this room even, you must have had some sort of longing for awakening, some desire to be different. You must have had some sort of faith that even an inkling that there is something that's going to be here that's different to what you get elsewhere. And to do that, you must have heard Amida calling somehow. You must have had an intuition of Amida's call at some point in your life. So you can see that as the beginning stages of the spiritual path. Then on top of that, once you develop faith, naturally you start to cultivate the virtues. This is a classic sort of Buddhist syllabus. First of all, you take refuge, then you practice the precepts, then you do meditation and cultivate wisdom. Dhammavijja suggests that, although that can also happen in the other way around, actually people come to Buddhism, I think particularly in the West sometimes, and they start at the other end. Either they start by trying to understand ideas intellectually and gain wisdom and sort of jump to the end and think, oh, what's emptiness? You know, once I've understood those wisdom teachings and I'll be sorted. Or they put their heart and soul into doing good, into repressing evil thoughts and just cultivating, doing good in the world. Like that sort of, like the practice I talked about where for the Buddha, the thoughts don't arise, but for us actually, we're noticing the thoughts and not speaking them. Well, you can, if you do either of those things, you will reach a point where you realize, if you do them in the spirit that I've just described, you will reach a point where you realize that they're not working. And at that point, you can think of that as a kind of spiritual death, I suppose. At that point, you reach beyond yourself again to something beyond. You realize that doing good for the sake of becoming enlightened, doing good for the sake of making yourself look good, doing good for anything other than the sake of doing good won't work. So if you do it in the spirit of trying to get something, eventually you'll have a breakdown, like the story of Kuan Yin. Again, with the wisdom teachings, if you try and understand things deeply, eventually you'll reach a point where sort of nothing really makes any sense until you go beyond yourself and are able to take refuge in the Buddha. Or you will have an awakening experience, but that experience will be an awakening into your bombu nature, into the greed, hate and delusion that flows through you, and into the Buddha's nature as being free from those things. So the 18th vow is about hearing the name of the Buddha, wanting to go to the Pure Land, and keeping the Buddha in mind with settled faith. If you do all of those things, the Buddha will appear before you. And it says here at the time of death, and of course, traditionally it was understood that way, but also you can think that you have many deaths over the course of one lifetime. You know, when I realized that nothing was working for me and decided that I was going to move into the Buddhist house, that was a kind of death of a particular self, or it was the beginning of a kind of death, because actually I held on to all of those strategies that I'd been relying on before, even throughout much of my Buddhist training. And as that old personality dies, it makes way, made way for one that was more able to be in touch with Amita. So the 19th vow is the one about cultivating virtues, and it says, O blessed one, may I not come to complete awakening if when I have done so, living beings inhabiting other worlds who conceive a longing for awakening, who cultivate all virtues, who listen to my name, and who resolve single-mindedly to be born in my land, are not assured of meeting me standing before them in full retinue and glory at the time of their death. So that's exactly the same so far, apart from one line which says, cultivate all virtues. So you can either cultivate them or not, basically, because in the previous one it doesn't mention it, and in this one it does. So it's good to do, but it's not essential to getting born in the Pure Land. It then goes on to say, except for those who have committed the five heinous offences, as well as those who are obstructed by their own opposition to the Dharma. Now, if I'd done my homework, I could tell you what the five heinous offences were, but one of them is causing a schism in the Sangha. One of them is killing your own parents. And they're pretty horrible things to do, whatever they are. And the sixth one here that it adds on is obstructed by your own opposition to the Dharma. But it's significant that this line doesn't appear in the 18th vow. So in the 18th vow, it doesn't mention virtue at all, and it doesn't say that you won't go to the Pure Land if you commit one of these offences. In the 19th vow, it says, if you're trying to get into the Pure Land by being virtuous, you can actually, you can do that, but not if you commit one of these really bad things because the karma is too heavy to get you into there. But because of the 18th vow earlier, we know that even if you do commit one of those offences, you're still fine, actually. You can still go into the Pure Land. It's saying that, often it's talked about as the 19th and the 20th vow being better ways to get into the Pure Land. And I think, I don't know if it's in this at the end of this text or another text, it talks about, I don't think it's this one, there's another sutra where it talks about the more virtuous you've been in a previous life, the closer to Amida you're born in the Pure Land in your next life. So if you've committed one of these, then you are born in the Pure Land, but quite far away from the Buddha, and maybe in a closed lotus flower that takes a long time to open while you consider, while you work through all your karma. But that's if you're relying on virtue to get into the Pure Land. If you're just relying on your faith in the Buddha, then you don't need to worry about that. So some people would say that they are important, that it does make a difference. But in the Pure Land tradition, well, actually, it's very clear in the 18th vow that you get to the Pure Land by listening to Amida's name. And actually, we feel that it's impossible to cultivate the virtues perfectly in this lifetime anyway. So although it's a good thing to aim for, we don't really have any expectation that we'll meet those ideals. You know, we know that schisms do occur in sanghas. We know that at least emotionally we kill our parents, if not physically, and we do get in our own way in terms of practicing the Dharma. So for beings like us, we rely on the 18th vow, and that's where the Pure Land tradition comes from, really. For better beings than us, they can use the 19th vow to go to the Pure Land. So does that make sense at all? A little bit.
This image is sort of like waiting with us stuck with your little...
Well,
the
18th
now.
Yeah. Number 18.
I've got number 19.
Yeah. You've only got 19. Oh dear. Well, unfortunately, because you've done one of these things. No, even if you've done one of those, it's fine. But
then you get dropped off at the outskirts.
Yeah. Yeah.
It does feel paradoxical.
Yeah. I mean, don't we just written. I'm just rereading what Don Vidya wrote to see if it sheds any more helpful light on this. Well, I'll read what he says, and you can. So let me read the 20th vow first. So this is the third one. Oh, blessed one, may I not come to the complete awakening if, when I have done so, living beings inhabiting other worlds who listen to my name, who fix their minds upon my land, and who, having cultivated all virtues, dedicate all the merit thereof to rebirth in my Pure Land, are not reborn in my Pure Land. So, that's it's called naturalization by samadhi, so it's about having a clear insight into something. And the practice of that here is relating wisdom to the practice of transferring merit. Dharmavidya says, the 18th, 19th and 20th vows are generally regarded as pivotal ones, and they are sometimes therefore simply referred to as the three vows. They describe the three modes of salvation, by virtue, samadhi and faith. These correspond to the sila, samadhi and prajna of the agamas. So that's the classic Buddhist syllabus that I mentioned earlier. Sila means restraint and refers to the precepts. So that's like the practice of noticing when you're about to hit somebody and not doing it. Samadhi is meditation practices, and prajna is insight or wisdom. The 19th vow corresponds to sila, so that's the one about virtue. The 20th to samadhi, and the 18th to prajna, so, which is wisdom. In Pure Land Buddhism, prajna corresponds to prasada, which means faith and clarity. A person of faith is clear what they're doing with their life. Prajna is generally translated as wisdom, but the implication is really an ability to see below the surface of things. This means to see the spirit rather than the mere manifestation. A person of prajna is a spiritual person. They live their life in the spiritual dimension. A person who has clarity about life has the faith to go forward. The 19th and 20th vows represent stages that practitioners commonly pass through, beginning in a position where the only spiritual power they recognize as their own, the 19th, progressing to a position where they recognize both their own power and the Buddha, the 20th, and finally reaching the position of a complete reliance upon other power, the 18th. And Dhammavijja says the vows are in the order they are because the 18th is the main point, while the other two are acknowledged as valid other positions. But as I said, you could take it, you can either understand your practice as starting with virtue, or you can understand it as starting with faith and then coming back around to faith again once you've passed through the other stages. So we've got the vow about faith, listening to the name of the Buddha, the vow about practicing virtue, and which is relying on self-power, and then the vow about practicing virtue and transferring merit. So recognizing that there is something beyond yourself, but still partially relying on yourself, is how Dhammavijja describes it. And his suggestion is that once you go through that, you then actually stop relying on yourself at all and only rely on the Buddha's power, which takes you back to the 18th vow again.